Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a former U.S. attorney for Arizona with an inside view of the fake electors case. And we talk musical saints and who would be in your canon. But first, the battle between Senate Republicans and Governor Katie Hobbs over who she can appoint to lead state departments took another couple of twists this week. First, it looked like we had a deal between the two parties and that Hobbs had pretty much given in, agreeing to submit her nominees to the Senate for confirmation when the legislature is back in session in January. But then the judge in the case threw another wrench into it all just yesterday, and Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk is here to explain what happened and where we are now. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with a little bit of the background here, because this is a case that's been going on for quite some time now. How did we get here? Like, this started with legislative Republicans kind of changing the way that Hobbs's agency director nominees would be confirmed.
Yes, it's been a long, long journey. So in state statute, it requires that the governor puts their agency director nominees through confirmation in the state Senate. And you know, Governor Hobbs is a Democrat and the Senate is controlled by Republicans. And they did a bit of a shakeup when that happened with her getting elected. So instead of having the nominees go through existing committees, they created a brand new committee just solely for the purpose of vetting Hobbs's agency picks. And that was not something that Democrats enjoyed very much, because they basically didn't hear many of the nominees, and then some of them they rejected and only a few squeaked through. So eventually the governor kind of got fed up with that system, and she pulled all of the nominees and she assigned them the title of executive deputy directors. Right. But basically they were doing the same job and the same salary, and there was no one above them. They were just under a new title, so they wouldn't have to go through the Senate confirmation process.
Right. Okay, so there was this sort of combative committee, right? Tell us what we saw. Like, remind us how these processes went when the nominees were sent there.
Well, there were a few of them that were very controversial, in which the chair, which is Jake Hoffman, who's a Republican and the leader of the state's Freedom Caucus, was really grilling these people. And there were a lot of questions about, like, social issues. Abortion in particular came up a lot. And, you know, a couple of them, like I said, did make it through. But some of the ones that were rejected, it was like a huge production with all of this publicity and all these attacks against Hobbs and what a bad governor she is for picking those people in the first place. And, you know, lots of insults being traded, et cetera.
Seemed to inject some politics into the process. It ended up in court after Hobbs sort of did this go around, as you mentioned. What happened there?
Well, a few things. So the judge ruled that Hobbs was indeed in violation of the law, that she can't just do that and circumvent the process that's in the law. And then he asked the parties to work together and come to their own agreement on how to deal with this going forward. He didn't say exactly what they should do. So we've been sort of waiting for that to happen over the past few weeks as they've talked and come up with finally an agreement, which I assume we're about to talk about.
Yes. Tell us, what was it, the agreement they announced this week?
Well, it was essentially just another win for the Republican lawmakers, with maybe a little bit of a concession to Hobbs. So it was that they're going to go right back to the process that she tried to get away from. So she has to appoint actual agency heads, no new strange titles, and they go back to the Senate confirmation process. And the Senate president told me that he's planning to do it like it was before. So presumably that's through Jake Hoffman's committee, which was the starting point of all of this. But there was one thing where they asked the judge to say that a previous ruling was being vacated or thrown out because they don't want what the deputy agency directors have done in the meantime to be considered unlawful.
Right.
But then the new twist from just yesterday, I believe the judge said, no, I don't want to vacate my own ruling. You can come up with a better agreement, or we can we can talk about it in court.
Well,
so
okay, so more to come on that front. But it looks like, you know, it's Hobbs is probably going to have to send her nominees back to the Senate next session, back through this committee. But if we're talking about next session, Cameron, this could look very different than it did last year, right?
Well, yes, because we're about to go into the general election, and every year or every 2 years that there's an election, the Democrats say that they're going to flip the legislature or at least tie up the chambers. And of course, that is a possibility. I don't know if the Democrats are going to get the Senate or not, but if they were somehow to do that or to tie it up, then yes, potentially it would be a very different process. And I certainly don't think the Democrats would let it be Jake Hoffman's committee anymore.
Right. So even if in the maybe more likely scenario that the Democrats split the Senate and have kind of joint control there, how would that work? Like, how are they going to come to an agreement over how this committee functions and who runs it?
That's a really good question. It's something we've been preparing for. So it looks like, you know, this hasn't happened since 2001, but it's sort of a matter of agreeing on everything or gridlocking on everything when it comes to getting anything done. And so, for the mutual interest of getting stuff through the chamber, it looks like they would have to form a more moderate, for lack of a better word, coalition of Republicans and Democrats to make decisions and agree on things like who gets to run committees, who's choosing to hear the bills, because there's a lot of power for the leader of any of the legislative committees.
Last 30 seconds here. What does this mean for the way our state government is running? Like, is this creating uncertainty? Has it disrupted anything in these state agencies, Cameron?
I'd say it has from the beginning because, you know, when this all first started, there were a lot of director nominees sort of in limbo about when am I going to go through Senate confirmation? Are they going to actually approve me or am I going to get rejected? Am I still going to have a job? You know, and then the people who work under them at these agencies are kind of wondering the same thing. And then in the meantime, it was the concern of, well, what if this is ever deemed illegal, then are all of the actions that these deputy executive directors have been doing, are those voided? And now we're going back to the first sort of level of uncertainty. So lots of questions unanswered there.
That's true. All right, more to come. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics just joining us. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Immigration will certainly be a central line of attack for Republicans against Vice President Kamala Harris this election year. And now their own plan to address the issue is also getting some attention. Just this week, former President Donald Trump highlighted it in his broadcast interview with Elon Musk on X, promising, quote, the largest deportation in U.S. history. It's also in the official 2024 GOP platform. But this isn't the first time we've seen talk of large-scale deportations in America or here in Arizona. And they're often met with wide-reaching consequences, according to my next guest. Lisa Magaña is a political science professor at ASU School of Transborder Studies. She came into our studios recently to talk more about it, beginning with their long history in the U.S.
During the Great Depression, you know, one out of three Americans were unemployed. And at the time, Herbert Hoover attributed the unemployment rate to Mexican nationals. And so in the 1930s, we had what was called the Great Repatriation, where Mexican and Mexican Americans were stopped, and this was mostly in California, Los Angeles, were stopped, didn't have their documentation. They were sent, put on a train and sent to the interior of Mexico. A lot of people don't know about this, but that's the first major deportation operation. And I want to say Mexican Americans, so you know, U.S.-born Mexican-Americans that didn't have their documentation with them. We go another decade in the 1940s during World War II. There's a major labor shortage. And guess what? We need labor. And so during the 1940s, we had a mass work recruitment for labor with Mexican laborers. And we had maybe a lot of people don't know the Bracero program, which was a guest worker program to bring Mexican nationals in for labor needs. And so after World War II ended, 1950s, we had, guess what?
Another large deportation.
This one, unfortunately, has a name of Operation Wetback. It's not a very nice term. It refers to Mexicans swimming across the Rio Grande, Texas region. And so in the 1950s, this was another mass deportation. This was over a couple years. So over 1 million folks were removed over several states. So Arizona was one of them, California, Texas.
Yeah. So then there's a more recent history, right? Here in Arizona as well. Tell us about the Chandler Roundup.
So I believe that was 1997. This was, if I can go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. So as we know, Arizona became very popular for their tough stance on immigration, particularly Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. And so there was a little provision in the 1996 Act that said if officers were specially trained, it was called 287G, if they're specially trained, they could stop and question the status of really bad folks. So, you know, murderers, kidnappers, smugglers. Only then, when they were arrested, could they ask what their status was if they were suspected to be in the country unlawfully. And Maricopa County Sheriff's Office overstepped the boundaries of 287G. And that was where we had officers that were stopping and detaining immigrants and picking them up, right? Families separated, you know. Mom and dad would go to work, wouldn't come home. You know, terrible. And this was all from the beginning of 287G. And so that, going back to the 1907 Chandler roundups, was part of that. The city said that they thought they could do that as a result of 287G, but basically stopped and detained anybody that looked Mexican, looked like me, and that was found to be woefully unconstitutional, violation of rights, because you can't stop somebody just on the basis of how they appear. But there's been a real, there's a long history of these sort of operations, particularly Maricopa County, which we know is the most populated in the whole state of Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. So a long history here. And that, right, what you're talking about there is kind of when we started to see what we might think of when we think about Arizona and immigration kind of emerge, right? Sheriff Joe Arpaio, you mentioned 287G, local law enforcement getting involved in immigration in a way that was kind of unprecedented. SB 1070 comes not too long after that. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it's a direct result that when 287G was stopped and found to be unconstitutional and was racially profiling, and Joe Arpaio was found guilty, and then it was the state legislature that passed SB 1070, Senate Bill 1070, which was essentially all police officers in the state of Arizona can stop and detain somebody and ask them when they stop them, what is their status? That hasn't played out as much just because of all the lawsuits that could ensue, but it definitely symbolically made Arizona look again like a state that's really super tough on immigration.
Yeah, yeah. So given all of that history of these kind of large deportations, right, and what they led to, recent and not so recent, I wonder, what do you make of the conversation today around, I think the direct quote in the platform for the GOP right now is the largest deportation operation in American history.
So immigration politics has a lot of symbolic immigration laws. I like to say they're symbolic rather than substantive. And the reality is that it's disingenuous. It's not a reality to say that you can mass deport millions of unauthorized immigrants.
Right. So you're saying it's not even logistically
possible. It's not logistically possible. There's not a list of where every unauthorized immigrant works and lives. There's not enough person power to facilitate a major deportation. I can't imagine an economy, how it would affect, would be affected if there was a mass deportation. I mean, this is just, it's just silly. I mean, it's symbolic. You know, it's like build a wall. It's impossible. It's not a reality. But people like to believe that very complicated issues can be fixed. I mean, if we look at actual numbers, and I was just reading this recently with past pandemic and immigration policies, Special Order 42, and other deportations. There were actually quite a few during the Biden-Harris administrations in terms of actual numbers, some even exceeding during the Trump administration. So to say that the numbers are low, it's just not accurate. But again, if we're going to say, how do we assess immigration, that's a whole other issue right there. Is it the apprehension numbers? Is it this idea that immigrants come right through the border? That's not true. We know that almost half, if not more, of the unauthorized population are made up of people that overstay their visas. What do we do to address that?
And I want to point out, because you've written about this extensively as well, like the times that there have been, especially in recent history, large-scale deportations or attempts at them in Arizona, there have been political repercussions for that
absolutely.
Still carry out in Arizona mm-hmm. today.
Oh, absolutely. So it's very short-sighted, I would say, to be, you know, tough on immigration. I'm going to be the toughest sheriff, or I'm going to make it so miserable to live here. But we know that it's very short-sighted because the political implications are profound. And mm-hmm. that means that generations of children whose parents may have been, you know, detained or treated unfairly or poorly merely because of their status or how they look, or, you know, high school students or DACA students or unauthorized, these are all now at an age where they're voting, those that are U.S. citizens, let me be clear. And we are seeing that. We know that there have been activists that have addressed immigration that are now, we're just getting done with an election. We know some of the candidates started out as activists during these immigration debates. So it's definitely, it galvanizes. It's kind of counterintuitive, like you're tough on these immigrants, and it actually serves to mobilize and galvanize them politically.
All right. That is Lisa Magana, political science professor at ASU School of Transborder Studies, joining us to talk more about this. Lisa, thank you for coming in. I appreciate your perspective here.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, can musicians qualify for a kind of sainthood?
Even as my own faith and perception of the divine has changed over the years and become far less tied to one specific religion, that element of music as a sacred space has never gone away.
One artist shares his near spiritual connection to musical legends. But first, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays announced last week that a former attorney for the 2020 Trump campaign has agreed to cooperate in the prosecuting of the so-called fake elector case. In exchange, the charges against Jenna Ellis will be dismissed. Also last week, one of the indicted fake electors pleaded guilty to a lesser charge, and we learned that prosecutors had asked grand jurors not to indict former President Trump in the case. To get a sense of what all of this means, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Paul Charlton, a former U.S. attorney for Arizona, who's now a partner at the law firm Dentons. And they started with what it says about the case to Charlton that Ellis decided to cooperate with prosecutors.
So it is like so many of the cases that surround former President Trump, a very ordinary prosecution and a very extraordinary prosecution, because it involves a former president, at least in this instance, as an unindicted co-conspirator. So it is quite usual, it is normal for prosecutors to seek cooperation agreements in any case. And so in this instance, it follows the same pattern. Jenna Ellis, a lawyer who has already pled guilty in the prosecution in Atlanta, Georgia, has agreed, in exchange for dismissal of her case, to cooperate in this prosecution. And cooperation is an important element in any multi-defendant conspiracy case. So that is, in this instance, very much like any other prosecution in this state.
Given the fact that, as you say, she had already taken a similar kind of deal in another state, did that make her sort of a prime target for prosecutors to approach and say, hey, would you be interested in helping us out in exchange for X, Y, and Z?
It did. And you can be certain that there are similar conversations taking place with other defendants in this prosecution as well. There are a few defendants who I'm sure might consider this in a very serious way, and any number of them who might say, no, we are not willing to cooperate or plead guilty. So again, this follows a pattern that takes place in prosecutions throughout this country every single day. The aberration, the unusual aspect, is the fact that it involves an election and involves, at least as an unindicted co-conspirator, former President Trump.
Right. Well, and so to your point, we already saw one of the so-called fake electors agree to plead guilty to a lesser charge in an effort to sort of move beyond this, I think, is the language that her attorney used. Is that significant in any way that one of the actual indicted fake electors said, OK, I'm done?
It is. And what you sometimes see in conspiracies that involve, or these cases that are charged as conspiracy, that involve multiple defendants, is that a kind of momentum can gather behind these prosecutions. And what prosecutors will typically do is offer relatively good deals early in the case. So you'll see Jenna Ellis got a dismissal in exchange for her cooperation. One of the defendants got a misdemeanor and the felonies were dismissed. But later in the case, typically, as the case moves forward, as you get closer and closer to trial, the deals are not quite as good.
I'm curious to get your take on the news that came out that apparently prosecutors in this case had asked the grand jury or at least suggested that they not indict former President Trump. Is that something that is typically done, that prosecutors presenting a case will say, here's the evidence, but you know, let's not deal with this person?
It is something that prosecutors will do. And in this instance, the prosecutor offered two reasons for not charging former President Trump, even though the pleadings show the prosecutors were inclined to bring charges against former President Trump. First, the prosecutor said there is a federal policy known as the Pettit policy, which generally prohibits federal prosecutors from charging a defendant who has already been charged in a state case with a very similar offense. So it's a kind of, if you will, way to take care of your resources, to make sure that you're not duplicating efforts. It is an awkward fit to say, as the prosecutors did here, that the Pettit policy would discourage a prosecution of former President Trump, because it is, as I say, a federal policy, not a state policy.
Yeah.
So the more convincing argument, though, and the more convincing reason that the prosecutor gave the grand jurors here was that there wasn't sufficient evidence to go forward with charges now. And what does that mean? Well, the grand jurors felt that there was sufficient evidence to show that there was probable cause to believe that former President Trump committed a crime. But prosecutors, when they go to trial, not before a grand jury, but before a trial jury, have to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. A much different quantum of evidence,
right?
A much higher burden of proof. So the prosecutor here was telling the grand jurors, listen, there's this policy, the Pettit policy, that's fine. But there's also a concern about whether we have, at this date, sufficient evidence to try to take to trial and to convict former President Trump.
Is it safe to say that that consideration was maybe even a little stronger given who the potential defendant would be, a former president of the United States?
I think the way I would say it is this, that another aspect of prosecution, both in the state attorney general's office, like a local county attorney's office, and the U.S. attorney's office, is not just that you have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but that there is, in addition to that, a likelihood of success. So what does that mean here? Well, former President Trump is popular enough that you could have a number of trial jurors who would want proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and even more so, perhaps. So while the prosecutor said, as of the time of this indictment's return, we don't have sufficient evidence, it still leaves open the possibility that, as we were just talking about, Mark, with additional cooperation, with additional evidence, they may find sufficient evidence to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, even in a jurisdiction where former President Trump has so many supporters.
Sure. So knowing what we know now about how this case has proceeded so far, I'm curious what you, a former prosecutor, state and federal, what are you looking for to sort of divine, you know, and read the tea leaves about how this might be going? What are you going to be looking for going forward?
Well, let me begin with this. I assume good faith because in my experience, 99% of prosecutors act in good faith. And what that tells me is that the prosecutors here have not only proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but a reasonable likelihood of success at trial. Now, there's still the presumption of innocence. Every single one of these defendants are, as dictated by our Constitution, presumed innocent. But mm-hmm. If you're asking, how do I feel about this case? Experience tells me that prosecutors must have a high degree of confidence in a good outcome for the prosecution here, or this case would not have been brought. That's how I see this. Having said all of that, jurors can be unpredictable. And as we talked about, this is a state in which there are a number of supporters of former President Trump. So if I were just standing back, and I am just standing back, don't have any clients involved in this, watching this case proceed, I expect that the prosecutors brought this case because they believe they have enough evidence to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, that they believe that there is a likelihood of success. But I also believe that they have enough humility, and this is something that experience teaches you, to know that you cannot predict what juries will do. So we'll see how this turns out. We'll see whether or not prosecutors can overcome the burden. We'll see if there are more individuals who come forward and agree to cooperate, which would increase the likelihood that the prosecutors may find themselves successful before a jury at the end of the day.
Interesting. All right. That is Paul Charlton, former U.S. attorney for Arizona, now a partner at Dentons. Paul, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Nice to talk with you, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. If you are a wine drinker, you've probably heard of California's Napa Valley. The region is world-renowned for its climate, where wineries grow a wide range of grapes with nuanced flavor and texture. Every year, millions of wine drinkers flock to Napa to drink world-class wines and eat in Michelin-star restaurants. Arizona's climate is also world-renowned, albeit for slightly different reasons. You might assume our state's punishing heat is the last place a sensitive wine grape would flourish. But in a recent piece for Phoenix Magazine, Craig Outier profiled some winemakers who honed their craft in Napa and are now making award-winning wines just a few hours away from the valley. And they're not just imitating what they learned in California. As Outier told the show's Sam Dingman, when you drink Arizona wine, you can taste where it's from.
It's surprisingly easy to grow grapes in Arizona. I don't mean easy because I know growing wine grapes is not easy and farming is not easy. But in these kind of Goldilocks zones in Arizona, we're talking 3,500 feet in elevation and 5,000 feet. You can grow really nice wine grapes.
And if you had to, I mean, I realize this is totally subjective, but if you had to give a kind of flavor profile to Arizona wine grapes,
right,
as distinct from Napa.
Sure. The grapes that do well here are generally kind of the what they call the old world grapes and Rhone styles. Rhone is that southern region in France that tends to be warmer. Syrah, Grenache, those kinds of grapes. They often are medium bodied. They're not real silky or lush, but they've got good structure. So tannin and minerality, that kind of thing.
So there's also this pipeline of winemakers who are coming into our state from Napa.
Sure, yeah.
What made them choose Arizona?
At least 20 years ago, the cost of land was minuscule, especially compared to California. You could get a like an acre of land in Wilcox for $1,000. I mean, it was, you know, it was pretty dang cheap.
Pretty sure you can get an acorn of land.
Yeah,
in Napa
exactly.
For $1,000.
Right. A kernel of land. That, I think, was certainly the initial appeal of Arizona. But I think what you see now are enthusiasts. You see people who are looking for a second career. Maybe they're retired. This is kind of the new profile of the Arizona winemaker. They'll be like, you know, we've got a little money. Let's buy some land. Maybe they take a class at the Southwestern Wine Center up at Yavapai College. You know, they just make a go of it. Maybe it's not profitable in the outset, maybe never, but certainly a nice lifestyle.
Yeah. So that makes me think about this term that I encountered in your piece that I had never heard before, which is the third plane.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us what the third plane is.
I kind of got that secondhand. Now, that's from Pavle Milich. If you have been eating and drinking in Arizona, and specifically Phoenix, for any amount of time, you probably have come across this guy. He got into winemaking himself. He actually lived in Napa for a while, worked in the food and beverage industry, got to know a lot of winemakers, kind of planted the kernel in his own head of starting a winery. And now he's done it down in Elgin, which is a town in southern Arizona near Sonoyta. And this is kind of where you find a lot of the best wineries in Arizona. And that was his phrase. And that is the moment where, you know, you're wine tasting and you realize how well and what can happen when you pair wine with food and both simultaneously uplift each other.
Yeah. Yeah. What was interesting to me about that is that I believe this is still Milich that you're quoting here. One of the other things that he says he has tried to bring back with him is he says, quote, "My pet peeve is apathy, and we don't tolerate apathy here," speaking about his own properties.
Down, yeah, exactly. I think that to me spoke to focus. You, the idea that you're not just creating a volume wine that people can drink in volume amounts in your tasting room, then move on. It's so hard to get a winery off the ground, and it's still such an its infancy stage down there that you need to be emotionally invested to make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have the sense, and tell me if you think this is a misunderstanding, that a lot of the wine culture in Northern California emanates from the fact that environmentally it is such an ideal place to grow wine. And while there are strong personalities who have shaped the culture there, it's mostly the opportunity to grow and make money off of really good wine that has created that world.
Right.
From the way you're talking about it and from the way you write about it, I have the sense here that though it does turn out that our climate can produce some really good wine, the culture and community is a little bit more people-driven.
Definitely people-driven.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder if that will lead to just a different way of wine culture taking shape here, so that it's less about, like, it's almost like a religious pilgrimage to go to California.
Right, right.
Here it seems like it's almost more like going to a carnival or something.
Yeah, right. It is. It's Manager James Keenan just unleashed this crazy pyramid-like ziggurat wine production slash restaurant, has a has a motorized carriage that takes you up to the top. I mean, it's nuts. It's definitely more of a Todd Browning Freaks kind of thing than, it's like, why are you doing this in California, in Arizona? There's still that mindset out there, even as great as the wines have gotten. So yeah, it does have that oddball misfit thing going on that Napa doesn't have. They're the gold standard. But yeah, it's sort of like having a movie industry in Boise or something. I mean, you could make amazing movies there, but everyone's always going to cock an eyebrow, which is great. I hope they always cock an eyebrow at Arizona wine when they figure out it's good. You know, that's kind of the fun of it. You know, Pavle had a great line in that story. He told me, you go to California and the environment is much more hospitable to a wide range of grapes. You look at the grapes off the vine there. They look like they've just been to the spa, You come here and the grapes karate chop you because they've struggled, right?
Do you think you could describe, like, in the mouth what that karate chop tastes like?
Yeah. Now, that one I think is – I'm not sure if the third level has clicked for me to that extent because I've heard it over and over again. You can taste the struggle. I think that means if you just want to break it down maybe into its scientific components, at that – elevation that we make wine here in Arizona, 3,500 to 5,000, 5,500 feet maybe. You do get a lot of UV rays, and I understand that the skins are thicker because of that. So you do get maybe overstructured wines if you don't know what you're doing or you don't barrel them right or do all those little tricks and magical flourishes that winemakers do. And maybe that's what they mean. But all those things just add up into a grape that struggles, but like a great playwright, sometimes struggle in life is what turns a grape into a great wine.
Well, I don't know if the Elgin Tourism Board is listening, but taste the struggle.
That's right. Taste the struggle.
You can have that one for free.
See it on billboard.
Well, Craig Gauthier, editor at Phoenix Magazine, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Who are your musical saints? Not just those artists you admire, but those you view in almost mystical terms. For my next guest, it's a long list. Jason P. Woodbury is a local musician himself, as well as a music writer and podcaster for Aquarium Drunkard. And as many good and bad things begin, this conversation began on Twitter, or X, with a tweet from another musician about the idea of musical sainthood. It's a concept that hits close to home for Woodbury, who told me he's always always viewed music through a spiritual lens. He came into our studios recently to share some of his own musical saints and tell us what the idea means to him.
To start off, I will sort of do the disclaimer or whatever, right? Which is to say, this in no way adheres to any single religion or dogma. I think canonization in the Catholic Church proper, let's say, you have to have a few requirements, right? There's like a overall virtue. There are, of course, martyrdom, should you die defending your belief or whatever.
Yeah.
Faith and charity, and then, of course, miracles. And
miracles.
So to me, songs are miracles. So all you have to do is have a good song to qualify as a musical saint in my personal canon. But at the same time, I think a lot about saints as somebody who has given something up or sacrificed something because they believe that their art has something important to say.
Hmm.
So I tend to think there is a slight trials and tribulations element to sainthood. So, yeah.
Just like Joan of Arc. Okay.
Just like Joan of Arc, as the Smiths once sang.
Right, yeah. Right. And you say music has always been kind of spiritual to you. You grew up in this way, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a very, very small church in rural Arizona, in Coolidge, Arizona. And I, even before I hit puberty, I was like leading the song service for the church. You know, my dad had done it and uncles. And to me, music and sacred experience have always gone hand in hand. And the most interesting thing is that even as my own faith and perception of the divine has changed over the years and become far less tied to one specific religion, that element of music as a sacred space has never gone away.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about and hear some of your musical saints. Who did you come up with? This can't be an easy list to make.
No, I mean, because there's so many people that I wanted to talk about. So I just kind of went with some of my gut responses. And the first one is the late Sinead O'Connor, who I think of as she's, you know, I'm sure that somebody listening right now goes, yeah, not my saint, you know, because she's known, of course, for a very controversial moment in which she ripped up a picture of the Pope on SNL. But when you look at Sinead's life, I think that she is in so many ways the prototypical seeker. She grew up in the Catholic Church, had a very violent and strong reaction against it related to abuse that she suffered at her mother's hand.
Mm-hmm.
But Rastafarianism spoke to her, so she's dabbling in these like reggae religions. And then, of course, I think she joined a break-off sect of the Catholic Church. And when she passed away, she had converted a few years earlier to Islam. So, I mean, so Sinead sort of had like a journey. But when I look at her music, and I could pick dozens and dozens of songs from the catalog, I just think of someone who, in that Irish poet sense, just had to sing about the most enormous topics she could, you know, the biggest mysteries. The song I selected is called I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, which is the ultimate aim sometimes, you know, this idea of being content. It's a real haunting vocal,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, let's listen.
And I do not want what I haven't got.
All right, so who's next on the list?
All right, so next on the list, I think we're going to go with the great Sun Ra. Sun Ra is one of the most fascinating characters in the history of music, hands down. You know, he claimed that he was not from the planet Earth. He was from Saturn, and he was in touch with galactic super beings, more or less, that imparted to him a message that he needed to share with humanity.
Right.
And so, you know, when the Sun Ra Orchestra, which is the name his group most often used, performed, they'd wear these huge robes, very ceremonial, right? But Sun Ra, you know, himself was sort of this figure who really pivotal in the Afrofuturism movement, and he often sang of angels and demons, so there's that, you know, in terms of like the religious thing, and he just tended to speak in this sort of gnomic, riddling kind of fashion, and I think it speaks to a sort of a saint, or maybe we're moving more into the prophet realm here, you know, but it's like these people, they don't always make sense in their time, but then many, many years later, you realize just how incredible what they were doing was. And so I selected one of the more serene Sun Ra songs, and it's called The All of Everything.
All right, next you have on the list Judy Sill, right?
Yeah, Judy was this sort of Christian mystic songwriter. She put out two records in the 70s, and this song, Lopin' Along from the Cosmos, is from her self-titled 1971 debut.
Lopin' along through the cosmos, and sideways I slide through the square.
And Judy grew up singing Baptist hymns, so she had this like sacred quality. But by the time she gets to making her own music, she had lived, you know, years, sometimes in really, really dire circumstances. Drugs, sex work. She's a perfect example of a saint who is far from saintly on paper. But when you listen to her songs, I think she just understood some sort of like William Blake style marriage of heaven and hell, like pain and pleasure, high and low, transcendence and damnation. For her, they're all in the mix and they're always happening. There's just a lyric in this that, were I to come up with my own religion, I would keep this as like one of the main commandments. The lyric is, so keep on moving or stay by my side. Either way, I'll tell you a secret I've never revealed. However we are is okay.
Tell you a secret I've never revealed. However we are is okay.
All right, next up we have at least one name I had heard of, John Coltrane, but you've got John and Alice Coltrane here.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, the song I selected is just Alice. But, you know, John Coltrane, of course, a jazz legend, absolute, you know, innovator of the form and one of the all-time greats. John and his wife, Alice Coltrane, made a lot of great music together. After he passed away, she continued making great records, and her music became even more overtly focused on sort of spiritual forms. This was the 1960s as all sorts of Eastern esotericism was starting to kind of make its way into the U.S. counterculture. This song, Journey into Satchitananda, is a song that she wrote about her guru. She's playing harp and there's tambura, and it's this like just really evocative soundscape that I think it's kind of impossible to listen to it and not fall into some sort of a trance.
So let's talk lastly about a song I think everybody knows and an artist we definitely all know. Madonna's last on your list.
Yeah. Yeah, Ray of Light from 1998. This is a song that I remember being like pretty young when it came out, you know, junior high or whatever. But I remember hearing it, absolutely loving it and being just so taken by it, but also being really nervous to tell all my friends that I like the Madonna song. Because I thought that made me
CD.
Like,
I listen to this every day.
Oh my
yeah.
Gosh. I mean, I think this is her best work, to be honest. And this is an interesting song because it's from an era where she was dabbling extensively in like Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah. And I think when I listen to particularly the song Ray of Light, it just actually sounds like a ray of light. It sounds like a transmission of divine solar energy or something. It is so propulsive and so, it's so immense.
Yeah.
I mean, the lyric, she's got herself a universe completely. It's like, it's kind of a reminder that we tend to think of the cosmos purely from an out, you know, the cosmos are out there. But I think when I listen to a song like this, it reminds me that the cosmos are kind of in here as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really what the song speaks to. And of course, the beat is pretty undeniable.
Yeah, it's pretty good. All right. We'll end it on that one. Jason P. Woodbury, musician and music writer, host of the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions podcast and creative director of the Wastewords Podcast Network, joining us to talk more about his musical saints. Jason, thank you so much as always for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's always a blast, Lauren. Thank you so much for having me. And I look forward to hearing what musical saints this conversation inspires people to bring up. Thanks so much.
And if you want to tell us your musical saints, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a note. We are at theshow@kjzz.org. Nothing like Madonna to end your Wednesday edition of the show. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you heard a song you liked on the show, you can follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app to find all the music we played last month. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us today. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.